Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, welcome to the Mobilities and Methods series, hosted by the New Books Network in association with the Mobilities and Methods Lab at the University of Illinois at Chicago. The Mobilities and Methods Lab and New Books Network provide a platform for authors, readers, and their interlocutors to engage closely with questions of mobility and movement. My name is Lakshata Malik, and today I'm joined by Dr. Brahm Prakash, Assistant Professor, Theatre and Performance Studies at the School of Arts and Aesthetics at Jawaharlal Nehru University, New Delhi. We are in conversation about his book, Cultural Labour, Conceptualizing the Folk Performance in India, published by Oxford University Press in 2019. Welcome, Dr. Prakash, and we're very excited to have you here and talk about this very dynamic book that you've written. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
All right. I'm going to jump right in because there's, like I said, and we were talking before, the book has so much to offer. And hopefully we can get to some of it and leave some for the audience to judge for themselves when they go and read the book. So the first question itself is, just the concept of cultural labor. How did that come about? How did you get to this concept? What was the journey like to get you to this book? Yeah, let's start there.
Yeah, so it has been a quite interesting journey, I should say, because this is not something I started in my PhD. I was engaging with the subject from my MA days when I started doing my master's degree in same school, in a School of Arts and Aesthetics. And then some of the questions that was like really occupying me is that what could be the reasons that like these performances of folk performances are getting marginalized in the larger discourses. You don't find there a space. You don't find that is getting certain kinds of theoretical frameworks. So it always becomes certain kinds of aesthetic conception. So whenever you discuss about this performance, it always becomes a certain kinds of ethnocentric, anthropological kinds of field in which you can go do certain kinds of fieldwork, but you don't discuss it as a part of aesthetics kinds of question. Same way, when you go to discuss about labor studies kinds of department, they will say that, but they are not doing labor. They are not doing some kinds of very hard labor. They are doing some kinds of cultural kinds of things. So what I felt that this performance is neither fitting in the labor studies discourse, nor fitting into these kinds of like cultural studies discourse, and becoming certain kinds of very liminal kinds of area in which one can think about these kinds of performance. And so, the basic question was that what could be the reasons that these performances, folk performances in India are getting marginalized or remain marginalized in the larger discourses. And then after a point of time, the question shifted to about their strength. When I went to the fieldwork, I started again, because I also have seen this performance from my childhood. I've been part of the community watching this, I grew up watching these performances. And then I felt that let us discuss about the strengths of these performances. What are their strengths? Then the question shifted from marginalization to this idea of their strengths. And then when I was thinking about their strengths, then either you are thinking in terms of their relationship with land or the labor or their relationship with certain kinds of contradiction, you will find that you don't have aesthetic categories or Indian aesthetic categories that we were using in our department, in our discipline, was quite incapable of addressing these kinds of questions. And that was quite a kind of paradox that you have largely agricultural country, agrarian society, but you don't have aesthetics concept around land. And that was a kind of same way, whenever you are thinking about culture, you are always thinking in terms of leisure time. That only community or class who have leisure time can produce culture. It means you are trying to completely get away with this whole idea of So Sudra cannot produce culture. The lower caste cannot produce culture. They cannot engage. Whoever, so what you are exactly doing in this kinds of aesthetic exercise, that largely we are leaving the whole area. And what we are trying to discuss is largely the kinds of monoculture of the middle class or monoculture led by the Brahminical kinds of ideological class in that sense. Yeah, so this has been the kinds of
Yeah, thank you so much for that. And there's so much we will pick apart from there, the fact that, culture is only seen as a leisure, a site of leisure and not a site of labor. And sort of coming, I think that's something that I find very valuable about your work as well. And, it's that it's sort of not drawing that binary between pleasure and work and that sort of binary, those distinctions don't exist. And we'll get to some of the implications of that in a little bit. Before we get into it, though, let's talk a little bit about the concept of the folk in your book. What does that mean? Because in the Indian context through colonialism, it has come to develop a very distinct thing. It's not the same thing as it is everywhere else. In India, it means something slightly different. And you touch upon the changing meanings in the historiography chapter that you go through. So let's lay that out for the audience, for the listeners, and what that means.
Yeah, in fact, deployment of this term folk has been really, really difficult for me. And therefore, I always put it under the quote, under it is a quote mark. Because when I was finishing my book, then I was not sure that whether I'm going to use this term, because the term has a lot of baggage, it carries a lot of complexity. But again, I was not able to decide what term to use. For example, at a point of time, I was thinking that I should use Desi kinds of Lok Sanskriti, Desi kinds of term. But again, my whole idea was not to localize these kinds of debate, because this is not about I'm talking about North India. It is about I'm talking about the production of services or production of certain kinds of cultural production across South Asia. And therefore, I also don't want it to get into these kinds of very localized kinds of economy of these kinds of production. And therefore, I avoided this term Desi and Marti. Then again, I was thinking about Lok Sanskriti, but again, I felt that maybe subaltern performances. But what I felt that despite of all these terms, still, I remain quite critical of this idea of the folk, but what I felt that despite of all the problematics, all the complexities, the term still carries the certain kinds of energy, certain kinds of evocation that only folk can, come with. And therefore, this ultimately that coming up with this term of the folk. So I'm not saying that I have ultimate kinds of definition about what I meant by folk. But again, it is the area, very complex area, in which I was thinking about folk performances of the subaltern communities. Because even if you're discussing about folk performances, then you have several narratives around either epic Ramayana and Mahabharata. One can also discuss about the folk performances of the upper caste. One can discuss about the folk performances of different kinds of other communities, ethnic communities. So I'm precisely discussing about the folk performances of the subaltern communities in a caste society in India. And that has been the kinds of my focus. But yes, if I get a better term, then I'm ready to use some other term also. I don't mind going for another term that can substitute this idea of the folk. But I would like to just add that, you're right, that how this, this idea of the folk, the authenticity, also becoming a certain kinds of, mobilizing kinds of term for when you are thinking about cultural nationalism and other kinds of, that whole, discourse that is happening in South Asia, largely, and India in particular. And then I'm while I remain quite critical of this whole idea of the authenticity of culture, I'm also quite critical of the hybridity. I'm also quite critical of this concept of the hybridity and diversity also. For example, many times what happens that diversity gets celebrated in the name of like, you know, so when we talk about like, you know, we have diversity, then we talk about like, you know, gender, we talk about caste, we talk about religion. But what we are trying to undermine that how in the name of diversity, we are trying to hide this question of hierarchy. And therefore, I think many times the diversity completely tries to hide this idea of like, you know, this notion of hierarchy, this notion of differences, and this notion of like inequality in that sense. And therefore, yes, I remain quite critical of this authenticity of the culture, but I will also remain quite critical of this whole hybridity and diversity that gets celebrated as a part of certain notion of the secular India or secular kinds of things, of the nation.
No, I think I completely agree. And you sort of jumped ahead, but that would have been our question with cultural appropriation. And we'll get to that too, because this is so important. I think one of the things that I want the listeners to know is that in India, the distinction between popular culture and folk culture is sometimes drawn to the effect of making into a binary, which is something that this book dispels quite well. There isn't a distinction between the popular and the folk in the way that we think it is. The popular existing at the level of the metropole or the TV and media, and then the folk existing as just like this localized, improvised thing that is happening, you know. There's no script, it's only oral tradition. The sort of fetishization of, you know, the ephemeral in the folk is sort of contested, but also seen as a space of potential, like you say in the book, right? And so that's something that we will get into a little bit. And also, you know, you delineate that whole, I think it's so important to look at the history of how the colonizers sediment something that was already there, right? In terms of the caste dynamic of something being understood as high culture. So Sanskritized text as dramatic text, sort of Ramayana, Mahabharata is what you mentioned. So these are seen as like canon texts, and everything else is like, oh, it's a version of the main thing, but that's not, you know, that's something that's been cemented through colonization and you know, the intervention of the British as everything. Let's go back, circle back to the question of what you were saying about diversity, because that gets into, and we'll jump a little bit, but I do want to get into the question of cultural appropriation, which is such a dynamic topic right now across different contexts, right? Here in the US, but India somehow sort of is caste is a very, you don't know how to, you know, if there is some academic discussions around that, you know, that there's some of that is happening around like Sadir and Bharatnatyam, and how Bharatnatyam has been sanitized through the project of nationalism. And there are some discussions around that, but you take that into an even more nuanced direction, because you are focusing on Bihar and Telangana. And if there's something that you want to, let's get into how, you know, you look at the nuances of cultural appropriation in that context. Let's hear a little bit about that.
So thank you so much for asking this question, because I also felt that what is happening many times, that some of the regions where you have like a lot of a scholarship has come, so for example, if you are thinking about Bengal, and if you are thinking about Kolkata at the center, or like Mumbai at the center, where you had a significant middle class who took certain kinds of like interest in the culture and like in this cultural field, and then they become very active kinds of participants, or you can say the active agents of like cultural appropriation, because they wanted to, as a part of the nation building, they wanted to inherit some idea of the culture, they wanted to participate in these kinds of cultural production or become part of the cultural kinds of class in that sense. But the same kinds of, and therefore I see that post-colonialism as a framework may not equally work across the region. It has different kinds of encounters. It has different kinds of, you know, like, you know, resonances for that matter. And therefore, when you come to certain kinds of peripheries, so for example, peripheral areas of Bihar, Telangana, or many other states where you don't have that kinds of encounters that has happened with like British colonialism, then you will find that maybe the appropriation has happened in a quite different way. Where like, no, even feudal class, if you're thinking about the feudal class, then they were not interested in these kinds of cultural renaissance. They were neither interested in the kinds of like, no, appropriating that cultural field, neither like, no, making that is its own part of its own. And therefore, what has happened, that culture still remains as a part of in the hand of most marginalized communities, if you're thinking about cultural performances, if you're thinking about the performing arts in Telangana, if you're thinking about performing arts in like Bihar and many other Odisha, many other regions, Madhya Pradesh, Chhattisgarh, and then many regions, what you find that still those kinds of cultural performances, performing arts remain with the kinds of the lower caste, and that because the middle class could not get formed in a significant ways, and you don't have that kinds of a strong presence of the middle class in that sense. And therefore, you will also find the similar thing is happening in North India, that you never had the kinds of a strong Hindi drama culture, because drama as a genre, drama as a literature largely belong to the middle class. And since you never had this kinds of a strong middle class in that region, and therefore you could see that key, how that genre could not become a kind of very advanced genre in that sense, that you can find in maybe in the case of Kolkata, in the case of like Tamil Nadu, and in the case of like some other regions, which has gone through different kinds of colonization for that matter. And that is the case I'm making, that what has happened to this field, like if you're thinking about cultural appropriation, and then culture as a site, or like performing arts as a site, remains as a part of something that has to be neglected. You don't find many artists from that site. You don't find the kinds of academic discourse that is coming from that side, because then you don't have like a middle class who could have taken these kinds of responsibility to argue for this idea of the culture. And that since that class was missing, and therefore you will find that key, it has taken a very different kinds of route if you're thinking about Bihar, Telangana, and many other states for that matter. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that is an important nuance to bring to this discussion, because performing, and especially publicly performing, has always been a more subaltern, it's always come from there, right? And that's, you can look at the history of Bharatnatyam, and that spells this out so clearly. It's like Sadhir started with the Devadasis, the courtesans, and then gets appropriated over the course of the nationalist movement, turned into something that is sanitized, it's not erotic in the same way, and it's something more presentable. And you're right, in Bihar, which is one of the poorest states and has a lot of, and we'll get to questions of migration, which you take up as well, and has a history of like working class, especially laboring castes, what you say, right? You call them laboring castes and laboring classes, and they are the ones who have been performing, but the feudal lords have no interest in taking that up as a thing to lord or anything like that. Not to say it's a good or a bad thing, but that's just the case in this. Let's talk a little bit about, because each chapter is so interesting in your book, you take up a different kind of folk performance, a different kind of folk. Some of them are rituals, some of them are not, and it's a very vast sort of array of folk performances. And I find it particularly interesting in the chapter on landscape, which is chapter 2, I think, where you talk about this one ethnographic vignette where, you're witnessing what is called Buyan, it's a Jagran that leads up to the Buyan Puja, and you can get into more about what Buyan Puja is and tell the listeners of what that is. But in this case, the shaman is trying to contact the holy spirits, and is failing, quote unquote, not able to connect, and that causes a fair bit of like tension with the audience, like what is happening, we must, you need to and that is something so interesting, because you don't necessarily see that. I think in this failure, what is highlighted is whatever the concept of the cultural labor that you present is like, no, this is not always going to happen the way, there is no script to this. There's actually people who use their bodies, their embodiment and their labor to create something, right? So I want to focus on that example, and like maybe you can tell us a little bit more about cultural labor as a concept through that, and what that means in the context of the landscape and the materiality of the land and labor.
Okay. Yeah, so that's quite like so let me just discuss about, given like a structure of the book, I think that is like quite important to make this whole idea that how book is structured in that sense. Because I'm taking first, like as I have told you, that I was interested in this whole idea of the what are the kinds of categories that becomes the strengths for these kinds of performances. And then I'm taking like, you know, one concept that can be considered as a part of a strength. So either you are thinking in terms of land or landscape, that becomes a very, very associated term to think about these performances, where the performers can be located, performance can be located. Same way, when I move to the materiality, then I'm discussing again about like, you know, certain genres of performances where the things are getting more merged, it is getting more like mixed, it is becoming a defilement. And therefore, like, you know, what I will say that, like, instead of thinking about hybridity, instead of thinking about certain idea of the authenticity, I would love to talk about defilement, that how like defilement becomes a basic categories. And since your whole aesthetics genre or aesthetic regimen has been thinking around this idea of certain kinds of purification, it was arranged around certain idea of the categories, very like no nice category or that kinds of like very like no very, very specific categories. And I think what is happening in these performances are that many categories are getting merged, completely merged, because it is not about like no choice that you can make there. It is about more about the kinds of arrangement, kinds of a strategy, and what is going to work for your performances. Like if you are thinking about these performers, then the whole idea is that whatever is going to work in the performances, we are going to bring that things. Like, no, in our performances, and that is the way they work. Yeah, so first chapter discussed about like bringing this category of the land. I am bringing this category of the landscape to discuss about that whole alienated or maybe neglected area of the category of the land in Indian aesthetics. And then I'm bringing this like, you know, puja, ritual worship, that is called Bhuinya Puja. Bhuinya exactly means like, you know, you can translate it as earth, you can translate it as land. So worship of land or worship of earth in that sense. And many times that puja is called like, you know, worship of Dharti Maa Ki Puja. So like, you know, also like, you know, worship of like Mother Earth in that sense. So what is happening that how like, you know, I'm taking a one concept, that is landscape, and then I am discussing it through this whole field of Bhuinya Puja, that is bringing this category in a more evocative way, that is bringing this category in a more, I will say, in an obvious way. Same way when I'm discussing about materiality in relation to Bidesia, or Bidesia can be translated as a theater of migrant laborers, then I am trying to bring that key, what exactly is happening with Bidesia. Like Bidesia then becomes a kind of genre that is in painting, that is in song, that comes in various genre, that is a play written by Vikhai Thakur, the person who came with this idea of like no theater. And then you also have the whole history, colonial history, about this like no this landscape where like no people are migrating or like going for this whole indentured labor in Caribbean countries. And then the society is feeling at the sense of loss, and they are creating whole new kinds of song genre that is termed as a Bidesia. So then I'm talking about like in that same way, like all the chapters are arranged around one concept and one performances, and performances here necessarily like bringing that kinds of categories in a more evocative way. And that has been the idea about like arranging these kinds of like again certain kinds of ethnographic fieldwork and conceptualization together. Yeah, coming back to your question about like how this like this whole story about Bhuinya Puja and how these kinds of like it is certain kinds of, you can talk about improvisation, you can also talk about certain kinds of labor, that you are rightly pointing it out, that what goes when you are participating in ritual, that you are constantly trying to perform, you are trying to like appease the deities, but you are not getting possessed by the deity. And what happens in Bhuinya Puja, that it is a very shamanic kinds of worship. But again, I am quite resistive of like reading this idea of like, this is the ritual, this is the theater, this is the kinds of performances. I don't want to fall into these categories. I want to read them through certain kinds of registers, the way in media studies now we use the term registers. So whether like, so what is happening that like, we as a part of modern society, many times not able to feel through that kinds of corporeality, we are not able to generate through like our own kinds of feeling through that kinds of senses, and because we are losing those kinds of senses. So I'm trying to read them through the certain kinds of registers. And in that sense, when like a person is saying that like like whole drummers are trying to invoke the deity, and then deity is like the person that like main shaman figure or the medium is not getting that sense, and like a whole disconnection that is happening, then they also do the certain, so you can say, one can say that it was a failure of the kinds of ritual in a very like interesting way. But whether is it a failure, can we read it as a failure? But again, the whole labor efforts that is becoming part of this kinds of constitution, and that becomes interesting. And therefore, I would like to make this whole connection thread that how I'm trying to discuss about this idea of like cultural labor in that sense. So for me, cultural labor becomes this whole sense and enactment of intents. So this, like, you can see, like, what the way I'm imagining these performers or watching these performers. So what the performers is doing, that very passionately the person is trying to get connected with the deity, but person is time and again failing time and again. And then what you feel, that there is a whole intense, passionate, ritualized performance is happening. So it is not just you are doing the labor. You are doing it in a more passionate way. You are putting a lot of emotion. You are putting a lot of imagination and all these things. So it is labor plus something that I'm talking about. And therefore, when I'm talking about cultural labor, then for me, cultural labor becomes a kind of passionate production of labor in a specific cultural context, in which, like, you are putting, trying to make this connection of labor. And that has been the idea of thinking about cultural labor. So cultural labor becomes a kind of creative economy placed in a hegemonic local context. And that is the way I have tried to bring this category. And, like, also the idea has been to also to bring this whole culture and labor, two different kinds of disparate categories, together.
Yeah, and it's very evident in your book, because it takes so much, you go through the method, you go through historiography, you go through existing literature, trying to very much get these two distinct and disparate spaces together. Like, no, they do go together. And it is very central to it that they do. I found it really interesting, and you just mentioned towards the end about, dominant regimes. And one thing that I remember from your text very vividly was you saying that cultural labor, the condition for cultural labor to happen is a situation of powerlessness. I'm paraphrasing at this point. It cannot happen outside of, it has to happen from below, so to speak. And it has to happen in a situation, a constrained situation. It has to happen. And that's what one of the main things that I found that's so powerful, especially in the context of the chapter on performance and performativity, where you're talking about this very controversial subject matter of intercaste love that it's called Reshma and Chuharmal, and it's between these two people who it's a non-dominant caste man and a princess, right, woman, and Reshma, and there are different versions of this play that you go through. And one of the interesting things about your book is you just don't analyze the performance, like, as it is happening boxed, but also look at what is happening, like, off stage and backstage, and, you know, what are the discussions that are happening. And there's this one instance in which the marriage, the people who are like, yeah, we're going to perform this play, and then there's resistance. Maybe we shouldn't perform this play because, like, the dominant caste community might get wind of this, and may lead to actual violence. Right? There's literal actual violence at stake in performance of some of these performances, and so you make the distinction between performance and performativity. And I want you to talk a little bit about that. And then also some of the performance strategies that non-dominant caste, laboring caste use to be able to express themselves, but also evade some kind of violence. It's very real.
Yeah. So, of course, this is also kind of this has been a kind of one ways of reading these performances through this whole representational categories. So what generally you are going to do, and it has been a part of kinds of content analysis, representational analysis, that what exactly they are representing and who are these people. And I would like to give my own example. So I remember that, as a part of cultural group, we went to perform in Rajasthan, and we were singing laborer song. It was a kind of theater studies conference. So we were singing about labor songs, we were singing about labor exploitation and everything. But again, that organizer also gave an opportunity to the real laborers who were working there they were working in a kind of construction company there. And they came and they sang they performed on the songs of Honey Singh, Yo Yo Honey Singh. And so, this is the contradiction I'm talking about. So, if you're going to see through the representation, you can see that these laborers are very reactionary. They're very regressive. They are singing on that kinds of very misogynistic kinds of songs. And we are very progressive because we are singing on the songs. But again, so I'm saying that how, for example, not necessarily that representation is going to give you the real picture. Something other layers are opening there. And I'm largely taking from James Scott, who is talking about public script and hidden transcripts. So how, for example, what happens that many times you are trying to enact something in public, but again, you're trying to hide something behind it. And one example will, I think, suffice this thing. So, for example, I'm discussing about Reshma and Chuharman. That is a very, very famous love epic from North India. And you have documented, a lot of documentation has happened around these performances, even by George Gearson, who was working as a kind of administrator in that region. He was a famous folklorist. So, for example, so what you are seeing that in the same time frame, what is happening that same community, Dusad communities are worshipping a deity who is grotesque, who is having a very grotesque image full of blood. But when they come to perform the same kinds of for the same deity, when they are coming to perform for intra-community kinds of theater, then they are doing a more creating a beautified image of Chuharman. Now the question comes that why the same communities in the same moment, historical time, are performing two different kinds of image, one very grotesque image and another very beautified image. To that extent, they call Chuharman is a Rama avatari, that he is another kind of avatar of Rama. So, and this becomes very clear that this becomes a species, becomes very contradiction, a species creates contradiction. We should also know that how some genres are going to work, create a certain kinds of efficacy in one space and may not work in other space. So maybe in the household worship, that grotesque image is still working, but when they are coming from outside of the community, then that is not working. That grotesque image is not able to provide you the resistance. In household or a familial image, the grotesque image is able to do something, but outside, for the outside community, so for example, if they're performing grotesque image of Chuharman, and then the Prakash will come and laugh that, oh my God, this is the deity they have, deity who does not have even the face. So this is the faceless deity you are celebrating. And therefore, they are now trying to create a new beautified image of the deity. And therefore, what I will say that how, so when I'm saying about that performance, I'm largely talking about certain kinds of representation category, certain kinds of performance that you are trying to show and you are trying to enact. But when I'm trying to discuss about performativity, I'm trying to bring the contradiction. I'm trying to bring the kinds of display and certain kinds of concealment that communities or the performers are doing on behalf of the community, or some agents are doing on the part of certain kinds of social kinds of framing.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
No, and that, again, it's so important to make that distinction, because for the longest time, performance study, and you have mentioned this in the book, has been structured by gender trouble, Butler's text, gender trouble, and performance is only just that. It's everything is, but power structures somehow get left out of it. And you're absolutely right. When you look at performativity, which is the situation, the context in which certain performances become publicly performed, I guess, certain performances become public. That's what I'm trying to say. That is important. Why certain things change? Why this deity who is grotesque in one location becomes more aestheticized and beautified in another location is something very, very important to look at. And I think that's something that you bring. It's this nuanced understanding of power relations in performance studies that is largely not, that usually goes amiss. You usually look at performances these structures aren't real, gender isn't real, which is true. All of these are made up structures, but people have very real repercussions in their lives through these concepts, right? Caste means something, gender means something, even though it's made up. And that is important. And thank you so much for providing that explanation. I do want to also talk, there's so much in this book. Again, I'm sort of leaving so much out and It's up to the audiences to go and look up all of the stuff. And I do want to get back to the Bidesia play, the theater that you talk about, because that, you talk about materiality on various levels, right? You mentioned this materiality of it's coming out of a point in time when a lot of laboring castes mostly are moving to indentured labor in the Caribbean. And there is like a hollowness. People have gone and there's like loss. And this play is coming out of that particular, this theater is coming out of that very real emotion felt in communities. It's very charged. It's very, and we'll come to the question of viscerality a little bit later. It's very, very charged with emotion. The other thing that you mentioned is materiality in terms of mixing genres and defiling genres. So it's this particular person, Bhikari Thakur, who comes up with this particular theater, which then changes over the period of time. It's not one thing, right? But when it comes up, he's taking elements from Tamasha and Nautanki, and it's not one thing. So there's also music, there's also dance. There's no purified way of performing. It's very overtly defiling. It's very overtly meant to offend these categories, these distinctions, and it does something so interesting with that. Could you please talk about some of that with respect to how labor becomes a part, how cultural labor becomes a part of this materiality?
Yeah. So in fact, like, I will say that if you're thinking about very direct and concrete connection in that sense, then I think Bidesia provides a very, very concrete connection where, like, you know, laboring classes, and I think that is a very peculiar kinds of phenomena of, like, you know, I will say Bihar, UP, and some other regions, where, like, you know, laboring class are having their own theater production, like running their own theater troupe. They are telling their own stories. And now we can say that they are running their own cinema industry. To that extent, and that I would like to extend, they're running their own YouTube channels in cinema industry. Despite of all the kinds of, like, you know, these kinds of, like, you know, contradictions about, like, you know, things about that, it is about vulgarity, it is about, like, you know, objectification of women, all these things. So I'm taking all these things aside, and we can discuss that also. But what I'm saying that this whole, like, you know, that how Bhikari Thakur, who himself was a migrant laborer for almost 30 years, is coming back to the region, coming back to Bihar, and thinking about creating a genre where he can, like, you know, bring his own, like, you know, tell his own story. And that has been very much part of that kinds of, I will say, culture. That has been very much part of that kinds of, like, you know, that landscape, if you're thinking about landscape. And then what is happening here that, like, yes, one way of, like, you know, so he's trying to bring in, you're rightly pointing out that, okay, therefore, like, you know, I generally don't go into this whole discourse of, like, you know, hybridity, because it is, like, you cannot find that it merged so much that he's, like, you know, trying to bring everything. And if you're thinking about pre-Bhikari Thakur kinds of scenario, in that region, or Bhojpuri region in that sense, then you have largely caste-based kinds of songs. You have, like, no caste-based songs. So, like, no Dhobiya Geet, Chamarua, like, no Chamar caste will have their own caste songs. Dhobiya, like, no Dhobi Wasserman caste have their, like, no, their own kinds of, like, no dance. He's trying to merge everything together. Coming from the lower caste, barber caste, he, like, no, trying to merge bring everything together, because, like, without maintaining that kinds of sanctity, that whole sanctity of this is good or this is bad. The whole idea was that, okay, what is going to appeal the audience, what is going to attract the audience. So, for example, he was also, like, bringing the songs of women. And to that extent, one can say that, like, you know, how, what is happening to the agency? Like, you had, like, a lot of debate in the, if you're thinking in that term, that whether you have female impersonator who are representing women on the stage, so whether they are able to bring the agency of women or not. What I have seen is some of the scenario that I discuss also, that what you feel that when the female impersonator are singing on the stage, you will find that women are giving chorus, the real social women are giving chorus to them. And that, like, creating a very interactive kinds of agency that one can talk about. Because when we think about agency, we think that agency is, like, very individualized. It is part of somebody's body. We are not thinking agency in kinds of more interactive mode. And what we are seeing in this kinds of channelization of performance, that agency is working in a quite interesting way, where, like, performers have taken the songs of the real social women in that sense. And now that social women are also giving a certain kinds of response to these kinds of song and performances. And then also I would like to read is a materialization. what is happening is a certain kinds of materialization. It does not remain two different kinds of categories. When I'm also talking about, I'm also giving example of pre-bhakti kinds of scenario where Krishna himself is becoming Videshi. Krishna himself is becoming migrant laborers. So you can imagine the scenario where like God Krishna, who is like sung as a part of like a lot of praises in the bhakti kinds of songs, with these kinds of indentured migration, with these kinds of like whole huge crisis, is like himself turned into a kinds of like migrant laborers. He is migrating to Kolkata, he is working there. And therefore, one can also talk about that what happened to this whole idealization of bhakti. Here, bhaktis are also getting materialized. It does not mean that like efficacy of bhakti is completely erased. You still have the kinds of efficacy of bhakti that is still very much working. But again, it is coming, the categories are coming together. It's a materialization of certain kinds of devotion that is making this whole things more interesting and making these categories, like I will say, more. Same way, I also discuss about obscenity. What is obscenity we talk about? And for example, if you're thinking about obscenity, then obscenity is the language of the body. It is the language of the materiality. And many times when we discuss about Videshya, they will say that it is a social drama and things like many things. But generally, scholars many times are not discussing about the certain kinds of obscene elements or certain kinds of like erotic elements. Use the term erotic elements more, I will say like erotic elements that has been very much part of these kinds of performances, where they don't make a distinction between erotic and religion, erotic and certain kinds of profanity and religion, and that I have also discussed in viscerality chapter. But that is the larger context I'm trying to make, that how materialization is happening. Materiality is like taking place in language. Materiality is taking place when I'm giving example of chair, that when Joker comes, then what Joker is exactly doing? He's trying to materialize that whole language with this the whole kinds of gestures, the certain kinds of language that he uses, he will use in that play. And therefore, I will say that how materiality in relation to Videshya is happening at various levels, in many levels in that sense.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, I think it's correct. It's happening on many levels, and that's very, it's, yeah, again, such a rich text, and I would strongly recommend people, because I think we can only provide a glimpse. You have to read it to get the full context. And I do want to move. I think this is a good point to talk about viscerality, obscenity, erotics of performances, which you take up towards the end. And this is because of the choreopolitics chapter. You talk about viscerality. And there's a very important quote on page 180 where you said, what distinguished folk performances from other performances, besides several other characteristics, is their extreme viscerality. It provides dynamism, virality, and passion to a performance unlike the structured virtuosity of classical drama and performance. And I find this so interesting because you mentioned this right now. And in terms of, I think, the best way to look at folk, it is a contested air quotes category. But I think the category of viscerality at large, I think, is a good way, or at least a comprehensive way of looking at what folk does in terms of desanitizing what our views of, distinctions between ritual and erotics, and distinctions between, where the body needs to be doing what it is doing. And I think that is something I'd like you to talk about in terms of, it's really interesting because the genre of performance you're discussing is dogla mukabla, in which two people, it's like a dialogic sort of thing between, that also ropes in the audience in many ways, because they're also part judges, because they're also like boosting the morale, and also like, oh, they have judgments very much it's at stake. So and the question of improvisation becomes really important as well. So please do get into that.
Yeah. So I also felt that how many times you're thinking about certain kinds of virtuosity, then that has a special attention in performance studies when you are trying to analyze certain kinds of appearances, larger economy of the appearances for that matter. But when you are thinking about more, I will say, that kinds of visceral category, then it is not you're not trying to maintain completely getting rid of these all these categories, the binaries that one can think about. Before Durga Puja and all these kinds of festival, there will be a news. Many times this media will take this news that they are performing these obscene kinds of performances during the Durga Puja. They are singing obscene kinds of songs during the Chhath. But this is your problem. This is not the problem of that people that they are performing. They're not making that distinction. Because if you're going to see, like, you know, many times, like, you know, all these kinds of festival parties, see this festival, then, like, you know, these performances are very much part of those festivals. And what is happening in this festival that they are trying to merge. So they will sing one song in, like, you know, dedicating it to Durga or some Devi. Devi worship part of, like, you know, certain deity, mother deity kinds of worship. And after that, they can just move to very obscene or very erotic kinds of performances. And then if you're wanting to maintain very sacred, profane kinds of categories, then you will see that what is happening, this is something, like, you know, completely, like, going against the ethos of the performance or going against the ethos about, like, you know, certain kinds of religious sanctity for that matter. But again, I think this is a problem that is, like, you know, carried by, like, you know, either certain kinds of moral discourses or by the middle class. They don't care about these kinds of things, and this comes, like, you know, together. So this, like, and they supplement each other. So when I'm saying that, okay, how they supplement each other, they also supplement to these kinds of religious kinds of performances. And same way, like, religious kinds of efficacy is also performing, like, you know, creating certain kinds of efficacy for erotic kinds of performances. And therefore, it becomes like a very merger in which we can talk about these things. And Dugola becomes a very, very interesting site of the study, because in Dugola, you can see that the movement, the merger in a quite a strong way. So they are, like, there are songs where, like, they're singing about Nirguna songs. They're singing about, like, certain kinds of Kabir songs, songs about many times death. They're merging death with food. They're merging death with, like, no place. So you have, like, no very pure element, very impure element, your flesh, blood, and, like, no certain kinds of sacred objects are going together without making that kinds of distinction. And I think that becomes, like, no quite a kinds of category that I think will not find analysis in existing kinds of, like, no very Indian aesthetic discourse, where you have, like, whole tendencies to see these things in a category, that this is pure, this is impure, this is obscene, this is, like, no accepted, this is not accepted. But I think these kinds of framing does not work in these kinds of performances, and that also lead to certain kinds of corrupting kinds. Like, no, these performances are corrupt, like, no, this whole category of the corrupt, that, like, many times they are labeled as corrupt, they are labeled as vulgar, not just because it is they are objectified, doing the objectified kinds of performances, but because they are also not, like, no, working through these kinds of very, like, no existing categories. They are breaking this category at a corrupting level. So that, like, becomes, like, too much. You are merging too much. And if you are thinking that you are merging too much in any caste society, then that is going against the very idea of the caste. Because caste is all about maintaining the purity of the blood, purity of the certain kinds of, like, no, gotra and all these kinds of categories. And since these, like, kinds of performances provide these kinds of a space, I think that becomes quite difficult to handle in these kinds of, like, no existing kinds of discourses.
Right. Yeah, thank you. Thank you for that explanation, Dr. Prakash. But in terms of obscenity, and I think it's an interesting thing because gender is, you know, it's hiding in plain sight over here. And I think you do mention that that's not the primary space of an, because there's already so much happening in the text. And not to say that gender is not an important category, it's just beyond the scope of a text of what you're trying to do here. And I understand that, but, like, I find that vignette of that that one anecdote about, so there's a very popular Bollywood song called Munni Badnaam Hue, which has been appropriated in many ways from an existing song, which means Londa Badnaam Hua, which is, so Munni would be like female gets infamous. I think that's your translation. And then Londa Badnaam Hua is boy gets infamous. And it's not like obscenity is entirely absent from popular discourses or you know, these are problematic spaces. If you look at the recent pictures of the popular Bollywood actor Ranveer Singh where he's posing nude, and obscenity is a very real charge there. But what that is not is how all the liberals would sort of, you know, defend it. It's also artistic. It's creative. It's not just like obscenity for obscenity's sake, which is, what you're trying to do is, like, folk performance is art, right? It's not just also vulgarity, viscerality, and obscenity for obscenity's sake. It's also art. It's also creative. It's also all of these other things that you usually don't extend. Can you talk a little bit more about, you know, this particular instance of this appropriation of this existing song, Londa Badnaam Hua, to Munni Badnaam Hui? And because there is some kind of cultural appropriation happening over here for sure.
Yeah. So in fact, like, very recently I published one article, it's called Erotic Power of the Dancer. and where I'm discussing about like, you know, gender absent, that like I will say that I could not, and I really felt that there have been so many things to discuss, I could not go to that total like, you know, gender areas, and that has been also like, you know, one can write whole thesis and maybe many thesis on taking this whole gender lens in this kinds of like, you know, same landscape where I'm talking about these kinds of performances. But yeah, so yeah, I'm also like, you know, so recently I've been rewriting something on this question about erotic, about this obscenity and the question of gender also. Yeah, but coming back to your question that like, no, yeah, it's quite right that when like, you know, you have like certain kinds of commodity that is working in a quite interesting way. So when you are like, you know, giving example of Ranbir Kapoor, like when he's doing something, then like, you know, like, you know, becoming and or exposing the body or positioning the body in a, some different way, or like, you know, in an obscene way, or one can say erotic way, then the person is able to generate certain kinds of economy, maybe like certain kinds of debate also. One can agree or disagree on those debates, and that was happening. What is interesting about these like, you know, performers that I'm talking about, female impersonator is not about just like, you know, bringing certain kinds of obscenity or certain kinds of erotic. It is about like, you know, they become the object of disgust. And that is what I'm trying to point out. That how like Munni Badnaam Hui, you can ask your son and daughter to dance on Munni Badnaam Hui song quite happily. That okay, let us dance on Munni Badnaam Hui. But I'm sure the people who are coming from UP and Bihar, middle class section, upper caste section, who are coming from UP and Bihar, can never ask their son and daughters or children to ask on dance on Londa Badnaam Hua. Because it is bringing some different kinds of layer also. Because first of all, female, if you are trying to become being a male, you are trying to become female, then you are also embodying certain kinds of femininity, feminine category becomes important. And then you also address it, create certain kinds of crisis for your masculinity or that kinds of imagination. Second, that it is also kinds of though you know the history, that who were the people who used to sing these kinds of songs. So that songs, the imagination of the songs remains quite encoded in the caste, in the kinds of community, that these are the communities who used to sing on the song, and how come we can sing and dance on the same song. So it is about it is not just about obscenity or certain kinds of erotic movement that one talking about. One is talking about the certain kinds of erotic movement that can create a disgust for a section of society. And that is what I'm trying to precisely address in this whole idea of the Munni Badnaam Hui and Londa Badnaam Hua, that how Londa Badnaam Hua becomes it is too unacceptable category. It cannot be accepted. We cannot see this.
Yeah, it goes beyond sensational and into the category of, like you said, disgust. It's no longer titillating in the way of like, oh my God, you know, it's something nuanced and cool. No, it's not even that. It's Londa Badnaam Hua, definitely a site of disgust. Like you said, you know, associated with the particular bodies who perform that, and associated with the specifically laboring, manual laboring bodies who do that performance, and you know, that effeminization and the crisis of masculinity for upper caste men especially is something very at the center of this. I think you've answered so many of my questions, and I'm very aware of the time, and I don't want to keep you here too long. I do want to, as a parting thought, ask you, what are the projects you're working on right now? What can the listeners look forward to? And you know, what's coming from you in the future?
Okay, thank you. Thank you for giving me this exposure. Yeah, so I have been working on two projects recently. One that I'm trying to work on in nonfiction. So I'm also trying to I keep writing opinion pieces about what is happening in field of art, culture and politics under the certain kinds of regime, or certain kinds of formation of Hindutva or Hinduism in that sense. And therefore this non-fiction, that should be my first non-fiction, and it is called Body on the Barricades. Yeah, so the book is called The Body on the Barricades, and Art and Life and Art under the Authoritarian Regime, and that will be coming most probably by the October. The book was, so very soon, it is coming very soon. Another project that I've been working on, and I'm quite liking, that is the academic kinds of project that I'm doing, is on the question of cultural justice, that I'm trying to theorize the question of cultural justice, because you know that in South Asian context, you have a lot of debate around economic justice, social justice, but I think the cultural justice in South Asian context has not been theorized. So yeah, I have also published one article, and I have been trying to Yeah, almost done like 2-3 chapters. But yeah, so next book should be Cultural Justice.
Yeah, I'm looking forward. You can see the politics like almost at the brim in this chapter, in this book. And I am glad that we'll have a space to, because I didn't bring it up because I've had conversations with you in the past about the concept of cultural justice. So we will see a lot of that. And you've written articles, as you rightly said, and people can go look those up as well. They're very informative and very significant to especially the authoritarian times in which we are living. So yeah, I'm looking forward to both those books, and hopefully we'll see you again on this channel with the new book as well. At this point, I'm going to thank you so much, Dr. Prakash, for joining us and for all of your insights. I am Lakshita Malik, and this discussion of cultural labor published by Oxford University Press in 2019 has been brought to you by the New Books Network in association with Mobilities and Methods Lab at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Thank you so much for listening. Do pick up a copy of the text, and yeah, have a great day, everyone.